This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, everyone. So what I thought that we would look at together is the question of, A, what are the things we're supposed to get rid of for chametz? Starting to answer that question in a very physical way, and then we can expand the conversation beyond the physical. But then also ask, how do we get rid of those things that we want to get rid of? So part one is going to be, what is it we're getting rid of? And part two is going to be, how is it that we get rid of those things? And we're going to do that by looking at first a couple of texts from the Torah, and then we'll look at some rabbinic texts on how they interpret the Torah on those questions. So let's start with the very famous, and by the way, anytime you call something very famous, it's because you've read it, right? That's why it's famous, because I've read it. The very famous 12th chapter of the book of Exodus, Shmot, which we read, actually, for those who were in shul this past Shabbat. This past Shabbat was called Shabbat HaChodesh, and we read on Shabbat HaChodesh, which is always the Shabbat closest to Rosh Chodesh Nisan, right, the beginning of the month of Nisan, in which Pesach actually falls. We actually read a lot of chapter 12 of the book of Exodus in order to remind ourselves, oh yeah, that thing coming up in 14 days, what is it we're actually doing and why? What's the history of that? So it's a whole long chapter that basically describes the moment of the Exodus and ritual prescriptions both for that original Exodus, right? The whole take the lamb, watch the lamb, kill the lamb, dab the lamb's blood on the doorposts, right? So we get that story, and then we get a bunch of rules about how are we supposed to remember this amazing event that is, at least in that chapter, about to occur, right? It's sort of a preemptive ritualization of an event that has not yet actually occurred. So part of that is the rule that we get in this first source that I brought you here in Exodus 12:15. So can I ask somebody to read that in English? So we're all on the same page here.
Great. 7 days you shall eat matzot, but by literally on, is that right?
Yeah.
On the first day, you shall eliminate leaven from your homes, because anyone who eats chametz from the first day until the seventh day shall be cut off from Israel.
Great, yeah. It's always a question of exactly what the nature of that karet, of that cutting off is, but we'll put that on the side. Okay, so we have a rule here. 7 days eat matzah, and also get rid of leaven. So first of all, let's understand that those two things are not necessarily dependent one on the other, right? You can tell me to eat matzah for 7 days, and that doesn't necessarily mean that I have to get rid of any leavened product that I had in my house, right? In other words, you know, if you say, like, eat chicken for the next 10 days, that doesn't mean you have to throw out all the beef that's in your freezer, right? Or all the vegetables in your fridge, right? It just means don't eat those other things. Eat this thing that I'm telling you to eat, right? So there's actually two separate things going on here, right? A positive commandment to eat matzah and a different kind of commandment to get rid of leaven. So just from this source, what might be the, right, given that there's no necessary connection, but the verse is drawing a connection, what might be the connection here? Why do I have to get rid of leaven? What's the connection of that to eating matzah for 7 days?
It's more appealing by nature, so you'd be tempted. Maybe if you had leaven lying around, maybe you wouldn't be so drawn to eating the matzah.
Okay, great. Right? In other words, if you're on a diet, one good suggestion for being on a diet, if the requirement is to eat something healthy but not so appealing, get rid of the more appealing things from your house, right? If you have to eat broccoli for a month, right, get rid of the M&Ms, because otherwise it ain't going to work, right? You're not going to be able to eat that broccoli with those M&Ms staring you in the face, right? So it could be just a totally practical issue of temptation, right? Get the temptation out of your house so that you will focus on eating the food that is representative of remembering this holiday, right? And we haven't talked about why matzah is representative of remembering the Exodus, right? But presumably we all know it has something to do with the story, right? That they didn't have time to let the bread, to let the dough rise, so they ate matzah, so we eat matzah, right? Also note something about that story. Do you think the Israelites cleaned their houses of chametz in that first Pesach? Probably not, right? At least,
They're leaving,
right? But there's two sort of like different, the chapter is very complicated, right? But in one version, they didn't even seem to know they were leaving that night, right? In one version, they were prepared, right? God said, put on your sandals and get all packed up and you're going to go. But in the other version, right, they clearly didn't know they were leaving because they were trying to rise their bread so they would have bread the next day. And God's like, okay, time to leave, right? So in one version, it sort of comes as more of a surprise than the other version, right? But here it seems to be, you're eating matzot to remember that original Exodus, and you don't want to be tempted by the presence of chametz. Okay, that's a totally viable, reasonable read here, right? We don't know why the Torah is so flippy about it, right? The Torah is like, anyone who eats chametz for any of those 7 days is going to get cut off from Israel, right? That seems to imply something a little stronger than Alana's suggestion of get rid of the temptation. But who knows? Maybe God is really, really against temptation. Not clear. Okay, so let's look at this next text. Okay, so this is just literally 4 verses later. Apparently the Israelites have very short attention spans, so God needs to repeat God's self. Someone want to read this next text in English, please?
Okay. 7 days, leaven shall not be found in your houses, for anyone who eats something leavened will be cut off from the community of Israel, whether foreigner or citizen of the land.
Okay, great. What's new here?
A person who's not Jewish effectively is supposed to follow the obligation of not eating chametz.
Okay, great. And I like the way you said that, Nathaniel.
But not eating matzah.
Right. It doesn't say anything about foreigners having to eat matzah, right? Of course, maybe the irony is, just as at least I discovered, my non-Jewish friends love matzah much more than my Jewish friends do. But I actually personally love matzah, but I'm weird. Right, so, but there's clearly a requirement here that the getting rid of leaven is something greater than or separate from the eating of matzah, as evidenced by the fact that people who don't have to eat matzah, right, just gerim, people who happen to be living there, right, gerim in the Torah doesn't mean converts yet, right, gerim in the Torah means non-citizens who have some kind of green card, right? They're not naturalized citizens, but they're just living there, right? They too need to not eat anything leavened, right? And what else is new here? Verse 15 said, eliminate leaven. And verse 19 says, 7 days leaven shall not be found in your houses. Right? There's, yeah, Alana?
Eliminate could be something symbolic, whereas not be found is total.
Good, right? Eliminate's unclear. Eliminate what? How? In what way? Right? And I guarantee you the verb in Hebrew is not particularly clear either. It says tashbitu, which is from the root, you may hear it a little bit, Shabbat, something to do with take a break from, right? Shabbat just means cease, right? Take a break from. So verse 15 may mean something like take a break from leaven, right? Whereas verse 19 says, no, when I said take a break from leaven, I meant get rid of all of it, right? Make sure that it's not around and that nobody has it, right? Which starts to imply, to me at least, that there's something about the physical presence of leaven that is incompatible with the holiday of Pesach. Not clear at all what it is yet, right? But that it actually physically needs to be gone. And from the very next chapter, the Torah goes even farther than it has gone so far in its anti-leaven crusade. So somebody read Exodus 13:7.
And some shall be eaten for 7 days. Chametz shall not be seen by you, nor shall leaven be seen by you in all your territory.
Great. So what does this verse add, or at least emphasize?
Seeing.
Seeing, good, right? So we have a different sense here, right? A different.
You can't open the closet.
Right, exactly, right? You think, oh, well, I sold my oatmeal to a non-Jew, and like, eh, let's put aside, right? Don't put it in the transparent one, right? Put it in the opaque closet, right? Okay, good, right? So there's a sense of sight here, right? Make sure you can't see it at all, right? Which may just be the same idea as not finding it, right? How do I find something? I see it, right? So don't find it, don't see it. Okay, great. Anything else that this verse adds for you?
You also had like Seor versus Chametz, like they're two different things. There's a differentiation.
Great. Do you have a sense of what that differentiation is?
Well, only because I've like learned this.
Good. Bring your knowledge.
That like Chametz is something about like when you make sourdough bread, that there's the dough that you leave over. Previously, the idea of sourdough is like combining the sourdough with like your new fresh batch of dough. So it's saying like you can't have like the sourdough, and then you can't have like the combination either.
Great, right? That does seem to be what it is, right? That we have Seor and we have Chametz, and Chametz is something that Seor has been added to, right? So Seor is that sourdough starter that's living on our counter, right? And there's the great New York Times article about like people who like hire babysitters for their sourdough starters, and they like feed it, like it's like, you know, like everything, a little bit crazy, right? But like sourdough starter in antiquity, right? Because remember, how do you get something to leaven? How would we make bread if we wanted to?
Yeast.
Yeast. Where would we get our yeast from? The store. Great. If you don't have a store, right? And before the 18th century, we didn't know how to produce yeast. Where does yeast come from?
It's just bacteria.
Just bacteria floating around. Right? So people in antiquity, right, and even nowadays, have to, if they want to leaven their bread, right, they mix flour and water and they leave it out and hope for the best. Right? So it's a lot more efficient if once those yeast land on that dough, that you don't bake the whole thing, right? You leave a little bit aside and that becomes your sourdough starter. Right? And so that's what Seor is. You're exactly right that's what Seor is. Right? So it's saying get rid of both the thing from which you make new leavened products, and sort of, I would say, obviously, any actually leavened products that you have in your house. Okay, great. Fantastic, right? So the Torah here seems to have a big anti-all kind of fermented bread product thing going on for Pesach, but doesn't really tell us why outside of, well, it's not even symbolic, really, because the symbolism in the first Exodus wasn't about destroying your sourdough starter. Right? There wasn't this, you know, mass exodus where all the Israelites took their sourdough starter and poured it on the steps of Egypt as they left and said, ha, your border is going to smell really bad. Right? They didn't do that, right? They just ate matzah. And the question is, what is going on here with this symbolism around Seor? What's going on? Why are we so crazy about it? So let's look at another verse that people often don't look at when thinking about Pesach, but actually is quite important. And it comes from the second chapter of Leviticus in a whole list of sacrifices, right? The book of Leviticus, one of the reasons it has such a bad reputation is that it starts with a list of sacrifices, right? Down the line. And among those sacrifices are grain sacrifices called minachot, minchas, right? So we have a verse about what you can offer as part of your mincha, or more accurately, what you can't. So let's someone read this verse. Shall I? Do you want to read it? Great.
No cereal offering, mincha, that you offer to the Lord shall be made from leavened, for you must not turn into smoke any leavened or any honey, as it is a food gift to the Lord.
Good. Great. So I just wanted to, you can't give it as a food gift, right? In other words, leaven is out in terms of what you offer on the altar. So when you offer on the altar, you can't offer any of that beautiful, delicious challah that you can buy in any store in this lovely country. None of that can be offered to God. God apparently is a low carber, right? Not interested in challah. But actually, God is interested in matzah, right? All of the mincha offerings have to be matzah. A little crazy, a little weird, right? So some modern scholars have sort of taken a step back and tried to think about, okay, what's going on here? What is the abhorrence of Seor? What's going on with this leaven thing? And why are we so against it on the altar at all times? And for all of the people during Pesach? Right? Something is going on beyond the story of Pesach to make sense of this. So let's take a look. So first we have Jacob Milgram, who is a great, great Bible scholar. Only recently passed away in the last 5 or 6 years. Lived in Jerusalem, right at the top of Gan HaPaimon. And he says like this. He claims, fermentation is equivalent to decay and corruption, and for this reason is prohibited on the altar. Leaven was regarded as the arch symbol of fermentation, deterioration, and death, and hence taboo on the altar of blessing and life. So his notion is that fermentation is like death. So why is that? Where does that idea come from?
People, it's not like a very Jewish thing, but trying to like prolong the body after it's dead.
So how does fermentation work there?
Like, because it's like you're letting something like sit out like very purposefully, like maybe there's like an association with that.
Got it. Right, so I leave something out, right, and it kind of like starts to bubble a little bit and decays, right? And so maybe visually, right, there's a sense in which it kind of looks like I've left some dead thing out. Interesting. Okay, great. Other thoughts?
Transformation, maybe? Because, I'm not sure. She knows about bread. But, it rises, right?
Mm-hmm.
You bake it, and then you eat it, right? So it was like a nothing, and then it became delicious. And
so, right. So that's my impression also.
So it started out as a non-edible thing, and it became edible. And with the death, it's like, we're alive, and then we transform.
Right. Inanimate. Right. So I agree with you that it seems like that there is some connection there, right, around transformation. But at the same time, I would have thought that transforming something from a lump, that if I bake it in the state that it's in without it rising, that it tastes kind of bad, and then adding some fermentation to it, and then it tastes really good. Right? I wouldn't associate that with death. I would associate that with life and deliciousness. It's a little weird. Right? I don't quite get other thoughts about what Milgram's saying. Connection of fermentation and death. I hear the transformation piece.
No, I'm saying it's the opposite.
Right, it's like the opposite. But then if it's the opposite, then like why isn't it a good thing? Right? Why is it a bad thing? Right? It's weird. I other thoughts. Yeah, Nathaniel.
I was gonna try to understand it from the perspective of a person at a bank. Stays the cashier all his life, or is still in employment. There's high chance for corruption, fraud in those kind of situations where these jobs are not on the rotation. Similarly, the Jews, as people in Egypt, remain slaves in Egypt all their sort of generations. There would have been no intellectual growth, creativity happening,
mm-hmm.
and that's an effort that fermentation that would have taken place, being stagnant in one place, would have been the ill effect. As opposed to being constantly on the move and the need to find solutions to things.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that, right? The idea is that, like, I have my sourdough starter and it's just sort of, like, sitting there, right? Nothing new is happening to it. But what's weird is that, right, just like we were saying, but if you add it to bread, it causes rising. It causes, right, it causes change and growth. Literally, right? It causes it to grow. So it's a little strange. So I have to say, with all due respect to Professor Milgram, I wasn't totally convinced by that. So then I found a different view, which I think hit me quite literally much more strongly. So this is Professor Propp, non-Jewish scholar, brilliant scholar. In his commentary on the leaven prohibition on Pesach. And so he says like this. Leaven in particular is fraught with poignant multivalent symbolism. I actually like that word multivalent because I think it captures this idea that leaven is both somehow like putrefying, right? Something dying, but also something that causes growth, right? So it has this multiple kind of symbolisms. And then he says, leavening entails both putrefaction and growth, death and life. Its pungent odor reaches every corner of the house. So that for me, as someone who doesn't have a sourdough starter that I lovingly take care of on a daily basis, hit me as something experientially powerful, right? Which is to say, the sourdough starter itself is both, right? Something that ferments and something that causes other things to puff up, right? It helps make my bread taste better. But the sourdough starter itself, especially in a non-refrigeration society without saran wrap, right, is just sitting there decaying all the time and spreading its smell out everywhere. So if you actually imagine what's going on here, Pesach becomes a time once a year in the springtime when everything else is growing and freshening. And what am I supposed to do as an Israelite? And not just as an Israelite, as Nathaniel correctly pointed out from the verse, right? As someone who lives in this land together with Israelites, at this moment of rebirth and renewal, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do?
Put away the lamb?
Right, not just put it away. Get rid of it! It shouldn't be seen, it shouldn't be found, you need to Shabbatify it, right? Cease it, get a break from it, right? And if we imagine the actual physical sensation of it, then actually what is the thing that we're getting a break from? We're getting a break from that smell. We're getting a break from that constant presence of something is always bubbling, dying, consuming the thing that it's a part of, right? That smell is going to be gone. And what am I actually going to get to smell for the first time over the course of a year? Not that, right? Something else.
It also seemed like it sort of epitomizes, you know, the thing that you don't actually have control over. Like, artisan bread makers who really have it down to a fine art and science have control over it. But for the most part, you're sort of at the whim of this thing. Sometimes it might work better, sometimes it might not. It might not take. So the thing sort of has control over you, and especially the way it's described here, the language of this odor kind of permeating every corner of the house. So to have a break from that is actually to be sort of the master of your own destiny for the first time in a while, and to say, like, you know, I'm actually calling the shots.
Right, I don't have to worry about waiting for this thing to rise, and is it going to work, puff up, more, less, right, all of that. And think about it even more, right? So on the one hand, it gives me back control in that sense. On the other hand, what does it mean? That after Pesach is over, what am I going to have to do?
Start all over again,
right? Put out my water and flour mix and hope for the best, right? And in a religious society, hope for the best means hope that God smiles on me, right? At this time of renewal, I start over, right? So in a sense, I symbolically reaffirm my faith in God to support me, right? To give me my needs once again. Right, and that renewal, literally renewal, has to happen at least once a year for the Israelites, right? But again, right, if we're thinking about all these sources synthetically, right, what it can't simply be that. It can't simply be that theological reaffirmation, because otherwise, why would Gerim have to participate, right? Why would non-Israelites who don't necessarily, right, they can't be doing idol worship, right, but they don't necessarily have to be doing all the stuff that Jews are doing, right, and have the same depth of faith in God supporting them, right? So it seems more like everyone is supposed to experience that smell-free rebirth and renewal, right? And Jews get the extra oomph at the end of having to rely on God to restart their sourdough starters. Okay, so that's leaven. In a very physical sense. And obviously a lot of interpretations spring up around leaven. I didn't bring them all to you, but both the New Testament and the Gemara both talk about leaven as symbolic of the thing that gets in your way, the thing that puffs you up, the things that make you arrogant, right? All of those bad things. So now the question is, okay, let's take as read that leaven is a bad thing, and the question is, and the question for us is, okay, so how do we actually get rid of it? Okay, how do we actually get rid of it? So let's turn to the second page. And even though our time is short, because it's Pardes, we can't not do a little Chavruta. So, on the second page, I gave you two sources. One source is from a text called the Tosefta. The Tosefta is a collection of early rabbinic material parallel to the Mishnah, right? Mishnah also is a collection of early rabbinic material. So it's the same sages, the same people, the same conversations, with a different twist to it sometimes, or giving us the background of the discussions that we see in the Mishnah. So there's a text from the Tosefta that talks about one way of getting rid of chametz, of what it means to eliminate chametz. So pay attention, because what we have here is a machloket. What we have here is a dispute between two positions, okay? So they don't agree with each other. And the question every time you see a machloket is, what are they arguing about? What is the point of their argument, okay? So that's the Tosefta. So once you do the Tosefta, then go down and take a look at the Mishnah. And again, we're going to see a machloket, a dispute. And the core dispute is between Rabbi Yehuda and the sages. I bolded those two names. I mean, sages obviously is a collective, but I bolded that. And so think about, what are they arguing about? Okay? So that is your goal for the next 7 minutes, is to read these texts out loud with someone you're sitting near, and then have those discussions, and we'll come back together at 9:40. Okay? Chavrus. Okay. Let us come back together. Disobedient. Okay, so there is one crucial piece of information which was inherent in the verse that we saw, but I just want to make it clear. There's a time limit for owning chametz, right? And that is up until the beginning of the festival, which the rabbis understand to mean noon on the 14th of Nisan. Because what happened starting on the afternoon of the 14th of Nisan? They started slaughtering the offerings, right? The paschal lambs for the delicious shawarma that we were all going to eat that night, right? Matzah, mustard greens, shawarma, delicious, right? Now we don't have the shawarma part. That's why the Seder is so lame when you get to that part. Okay, so there's a time limit, right? And now let's understand something else. If I say you have to eliminate something by the time limit, then the mode of destruction I'm going to ordain obviously needs to be effective by that time limit, right? So we're all on the same page there, right? I say it's got to be gone by noon on the 14th. That means whatever I tell you to do with it has to be doable by noon on the 14th, okay? So now let's think about the Tosefta. So we have a machloket, right? Either an anonymous position and then Rabbi Akiva or Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, doesn't really matter who for our purposes. They have a machloket. What is the machloket over? Eliminating chametz by selling it. What's the dispute that they have? What are the two positions?
One is that the time frame has to be enough that the chametz itself could disappear. And the other one, it doesn't matter. It's the very act that you sold it, it's gone.
Excellent.
It's gone from your consciousness or from your possession.
Excellent. Fantastic, right? Now, of those two positions, which one strikes you as the more reasonable? Judgment call.
The first one.
The one that says
that the non-Jew has sufficient time to eat it before the time of destruction.
Great. Why does that make so much? Why does that seem more reasonable to you?
Because that's harmonious to the reading of Exodus 12:19.
Great. Yeah. Which is?
Which is that even a foreigner or citizen of the land, he shall not have found in his home for 7 days chametz, nor shall he eat.
Good. The Torah says, get rid of it. It shouldn't be around. Don't see it. You know what the most guaranteed way of making sure you don't see something is? You eat it, right? And remember, right, we're in a pre-refrigeration society, so when it says you have to sell it to him in enough time to eat it, so what happens if the non-Jew doesn't eat it? What's going to happen to it, probably? It's going to be moldy, right, and inedible, right? So if something is moldy and inedible, right, that's essentially it being gone, right, because I have no more use for it. Okay, great. So on the one hand, you have the position that's attributed to Beit Shammai, which says, when the Torah says get rid of it, it means get rid of it. And that means if you want to sell it as a way of getting rid of it, it's not just enough to get rid of it from your possession, right? But it's actually got to be gone from the world. Okay. So this is always the problem, right? We've now set up the case for Beit Shammai so well, it almost becomes impossible to understand Beit Hillel. But let's try to do that. So Beit Shammai says, the Torah says it's got to be gone, get rid of it. Make sure that it's like consumed or moldy, done. Beit Hillel says, calm down. It's 11:55 on the 14th of Nisan, and your neighbor Chris, your neighbor Chris, right? You find a box of Cheerios, and you say, well, I could do a bunch of different things with these Cheerios, but why should they go to waste? So you sell them to Chris. Why is that okay? Right? It's not destroying it. Those Cheerios are right over there. Chris ain't eating a box of Cheerios in 5 minutes, I guarantee. So why is that okay?
I thought the difference was a focus on the object. The object has to be destroyed. And the other opinion, Hillel's, is a focus on the person. If it's not mine, then it's not mine. It's just not mine.
Beautiful. Beautiful, right? A different psychology of what it means to get rid of something is that I just don't have access to it anymore. Once I've sold it, I can't get it back with a lot of effort. Chris is now guarding those Cheerios with his life. So it's gone. In a different sense than it's gone the first time. The first time it's gone means it is gone from the world. And the second time it's gone means I just don't have it anymore. It's not around me, right? In any meaningful sense. It's maybe around. It's not around me. I don't have access to it. Can't get to it. So it is gone. It's gone for me.
That seems to be also a fundamental difference between Shmot 12 and Shmot 13, that the first couple of sources we read are focusing on sort of the general requirement that there be no leaven found anywhere, and it's almost like you have a responsibility to look out for the entire community, Jewish and non-Jewish, and the sources that we read after that, and the source from Vayikra as well, is very much about your individual experience of seeing it.
Exactly. Exactly. Your relationship to it, right? As long as you have severed your relationship to it, that's good enough, right?
But then I called Chris myself. I would not buy it. I mean,
you wouldn't buy it back.
Than, yeah.
Correct. Correct. So we're not talking here about the model that we use a lot nowadays, right, of selling chametz only to buy it back at the end, right, according to these
no,
early...
No, but I mean as a foreigner in the country.
Ah, right. So, yeah. Right. So... Already the rabbis are living in a different societal setup, right, in which they don't have political control over everyone, so they minimize their control to their own community.
Okay.
Right? They say, basically, I can control the shtetl. That's it. Right? But you're right to notice there's a definite shift here, right? The Torah would not have been cool with this,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
When you have a sovereign nation, right, that's a different world than when you're just living in a neighborhood and, like, doing your best to help the Jews do their thing. Yeah, excellent. Okay, great. So that's the first debate, right? And that debate carries on into the Mishnah in a different form, right? Because what's the debate in the Mishnah, right? We'll ignore the first couple of things for the moment, right? Formally, the Mishnah is according to Beit Hillel, right? Rabbi Akiva. You can sell it to the non-Jew as long as there's 5 minutes before the deadline and you don't have to worry about it, right? So formally, the Mishnah says, yeah, Beit Hillel, that's the way we go. But then we have this other debate, which is, let's say I don't want to get rid of it by selling it. Let's say I want to get rid of it by getting rid of it, right? Okay, so Rabbi Yehuda says, how do you get rid of chametz if you don't want to sell it? Burn it. Great. What's the psychology of burning it? Gone from the world, right? It's ash. It's nothing, right? Which position is that more like, Beit Shammai or Beit Hillel?
Shammai,
right? If you're selling it to a non-Jew, you have to sell it to him with enough time so he can eat the damn thing, or it'll go, or at least let it rot, right? So too, says Rabbi Yehuda, and if you personally want to get rid of it, you gotta mamish get rid of it. Burn it till it's gone, and you see it burn, and you smell it burn, and you know it's gone from the world. And what do the sages say?
Crumble it up.
What do I know when I crumble something up and throw it into the wind?
It's still there.
It's right? It's going to land somewhere, right? Just because I put something in the water doesn't mean that it's going to be disappeared, right? I mean, that's what the mafia wants us to think, but, right? All right, it's gone from me. It's gone from my possession. It's gone from my world. It's not gone from the world, but it's gone from my world, and that's enough, right? And those are two different ways of thinking about what it means to get rid of something. Am I getting rid of something from the world, or am I getting rid of something from my world, right? And those are two very different ways of thinking about something, right? One is, chametz is not fundamentally a bad thing. It's just bad for me, right? I'm a smoker. I want to quit smoking, so I bury my cigarettes in the ground. But I don't go to the convenience store and bury all of their cigarettes in the ground, right? Versus somebody who says, no, right? Alcohol is bad for the world. So it's not enough for me to just pour my alcohol into the ocean, right? I need to make sure it's destroyed, gone, right? And like we saw in Exodus 12, for everybody, right? And those are two very different ways of relating to what it means to get rid of something.
The parallel is nice, but it still feels like a little bit of a stretch to me in the sense that both of these methods are ways in which you could never conceivably get it back, and nobody else is realistically going to benefit in either case. So it's not really parallel to Beit Hillel.
It's not really parallel to Beit Hillel because no one's necessarily going to benefit from it.
There's no possibility of anybody else benefiting from it or enjoying it as coming.
Great. So I didn't add the Gemara to this source sheet, but the Gemara actually talks about if I'm tossing something in the water, do I need to crumble it up first or not? And the concern is somebody else possibly going to find it? Now, who wants to eat a waterlogged challah, right? But there's a position that says, no, it's not good enough that the challah is waterlogged if you still recognize it as challah. It's got to be crumbled up so that it's not recognized as challah in a way that anyone would think, I'm going to pick that up and experience it as challah. Right? So the debate actually does continue along those lines. Okay, good. So now I want to take a look at two more things, which we have time for. So go to page 3. And the debate between Rabbi Yehuda and the sages is a debate that in the Mishnah is just a debate, but in the Mechiltot, and the Mechiltot are two different collections of midrashim, of exegetical arguments around that sort of, depending on how you want to phrase it, either generated their positions or are ways that they talked about their positions using sort of Torah language and interpretive techniques. Okay? So the first one is basically the debate that we have in the Mishnah, but spells out something that's not made explicit in the Mishnah. When Rabbi Yehuda said, you have to burn it, how extreme was he with the language of, you have to burn it? In other words, it's 1155 on the 14th of Nisan, and I don't have a fire. My lighter ran out. My matches are gone. All the kindling around me is wet. What do I do if I'm Rabbi Yehuda? What do you think? Before we even read these texts, what do you think?
I have to find a solution to have fire and burn my
house. Okay, but let's say I can't. There's just no possibility of finding a fire, right? That's just right, and that's not impossible. I wouldn't know how to make a fire if I didn't have matches or a lighter, right? Whatever, from the city. Somebody from a more nature-related place might know, but I don't know. Okay, so what do I do?
Sounds like it's for suffering.
Okay, so one of my two choices, right? My two choices are either saying, fire is so crucial to this mitzvah that it would be pointless to do anything else, versus fire is the best way to do it, but if you're stuck at the last minute, do whatever you have to. Okay? So the Mechilta sets up that debate by saying as follows. Eliminate, when the verse says eliminate the leaven, it means through burning. Burn it. That's the ideal. Everyone agrees. The sages, Rabbi Yehuda, everyone agrees. If, however, the time for destroying leaven has arrived, but no flame is available to burn it, right? They were apparently city folks also who didn't know what to do without matches or a lighter. crumble it up and throw it to the wind or toss it into the sea for the fishes. That goes back to Alana's point about, right, if you toss it into the sea, right, presumably something will eat it, right, but maybe not right away. So in other words, ideally use fire. If you don't have fire, get rid of it some other way. Rabbi Yehuda says no. One must wait until one arrives in a settled area and burn it. Rabbi Yehuda himself used to say the mitzvah of eliminating leaven can only be accomplished through burning. Now I want you to be very, very clear about what he means. He means that it is a biblical violation to own chametz past noon on the 14th of Nisan, and if you don't have a fire and you still own chametz, you hold on to that chametz until you get to a fire, even though you will be violating a biblical prohibition. Is he just a pyromaniac? What's going on? Why is fire so crucial for Rabbi Yehuda that without it, you might as well have chametz on Pesach? Why is it so central to him? What do you think? What does he think is crucial here about getting rid of chametz? Right, that's right. That's what he wants. The question is why? It's hard to relate to that position, right? Because it's like, what do you mean? You're telling me I can't just toss it into the wind? What? Why are you so crazy?
It's better to have chametz for an hour more than to have it for 7 days of Pesach.
Okay.
Some form or the other.
Great. So let me just rephrase slightly. It is better to have chametz for a little bit and then utterly destroy it from the world than to do something with chametz where you know it's still going to exist. In other words, when you have something where the point of it is to destroy it, where the point of it is to experience its destruction and know that it is gone, and that is the absolute only way that you can attain the renewal that we seek on the holiday, then in fact, simply getting rid of it is insufficient. Because you can't just get rid of it. You have to destroy it, burn it, see it gone from the world. Right? In other words, for Rabbi Yehuda, the point of the mitzvah can't be accomplished in any other way because it would be psychologically ineffective to accomplish it any other way. It just wouldn't work. Pesach is dependent on the destruction of chametz, not merely the getting rid of chametz. Okay? The sages say, you're out of your mind. Right? The sages are like, that, what? You're going to tell people it's okay to own chametz on Pesach just because you couldn't burn it? You're a pyromaniac. I mean, what do you want from us, right? So go to the second text. So we have the same debate. It's in the name of Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda ben Bateira, but that's not important. Look at the last position of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi compiled the Mishnah. And he says, calm down, sages who think it's so terrible to own chametz on Pesach rather than burn it, if you can't burn it. And he says, no, you know what the real reason is? You need to destroy it with something that completely eliminates its presence. And what is something that completely eliminates its presence? Burning it. In other words, the Torah says, don't see it and don't find it. Bal yira'eh uval yimatze. Don't, it shouldn't be around. And if that's the point of Pesach, if the point of Pesach is to get rid of that old stuff so you don't smell it anymore, so it's not in existence anymore, well, then you only have one option, which is really destroy it. And if you can't really destroy it, turns out you can't really have Pesach. It's actually a very powerful, fascinating idea. It doesn't ultimately become the halakha. Practice is, if you're... burn it if you can. If you can't, right? Let's say, you know, you'll be sent to jail if you light a fire in your apartment. Right? Then flush down the toilet. Spread it out into the wind, right? Do something to really, you know, cover it in bleach, right? But Rabbi Yehuda would say, doesn't really work. And I want to look at one contemporary example in a totally different area of life. So there's this fascinating idea. It's been used in a lot of post-Civil War conflicts in African nations, where there's a peace treaty negotiated by the UN, by the local warlords, and then they collect all the weapons up, and then they burn them publicly. It's called a flame of peace often. It's been done in a number of different places. And what's the point of that? The point of that is Rabbi Yehuda. What does it mean to say we're not going to fight anymore? It doesn't mean that I collect all the weapons and then I sell them, or I put them on the side in a weapons cache, right? Because what does that ultimately mean? Those weapons are going to come back. And that's Rabbi Yehuda's point, which is, if you really are trying to use Pesach as an opportunity for renewal, you got to do something. You got to do some ritual. You got to engage in an act that will tell you, where you'll experience through sight and smell, that it's gone from the world. Because that's ultimately the only thing that's going to give you any hope. I can eliminate this chametz. I can destroy it. And that's what these ceremonies are about. We can get rid of these weapons, we can destroy them, and we can make a commitment that we're not going to go back to those terrible things that we don't want to be doing anymore. And it's interesting to see that that works to some degree on a national level. And I think also for Pesach, it works to some degree on a personal level. That if I really want to get rid of something, if I really want to experience the possibility of entering a new space and a new time, then there's actually importance to the way in which I get rid of that thing I want to get rid of. And ultimately, according to Rabbi Yehuda, destroy it. You got to really make sure it's gone. The sages also have a legitimate point, which is to say, okay, but at the end of the day, if you want to get rid of it, get rid of it, right? Do whatever you need to do to get rid of it. But Rabbi Yehuda says, maybe that won't work. Maybe you actually need to feel like you've destroyed the thing and not just that you've gotten rid of the thing. And it's a machloket. And a machloket has something to justify both sides of it. And I hope that we can sort of take the wisdom of both of those sides as we move forward to Pesach this year and in the future. Chag Sameach.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.